Welcome to the Everesting Podcast. In this episode, I'm welcoming back Tom Townsend, who is a Everester, a double Everester, and a cycling coach. And Tom's father, Sir Guy Lightspeed, that's Guy Townsend, and I did very early episodes of the Everesting Podcast with 10 tips on how to prepare for an Everesting. And Tom and I are now putting together two episodes with 10 tips on how to train for an Everesting. So this is very training specific, and Tom is an excellent teacher and very, very good at explaining some of the concepts on how to put together your Everesting attempt from the physical perspective. Excellent tips in this. This is tips 1 through 5, so we'll publish another episode next week, which will complete it. And hopefully this can last as evergreen content to people to use as a resource to go back to. And then at the end of episode 2, we've got all of Tom's contact information too. If you have any questions, he's a tremendous support to the community and loves everything about it. So make sure you reach out to him. Or if you appreciate the episode, give him a follow on Instagram too, because he's always up to something amazing. So Tom, thank you so much for doing this. It was a blast. And we'll have episode 2 out next week. Okay, so I am rejoined by Tom Townsend, who has joined us on the podcast before. And when Andy and I first conceived of this podcast, we wanted it to stand as like an evergreen resource, or at least a lot of the episodes. Like, some of them are topical, we'll catch somebody right as they prepare for an event or right as they come off of an event. But one of the things that we wanted to do, and a lot of these things are recorded in text, is how do we prepare? How do we do some of these things? And some of these episodes have been, we started it a few years ago. They've been played a whole bunch of times. Actually, the two most played episodes are the how to prepare for an Everesting, which we broke into 2 episodes. So 5 tips each. There's 10 tips for how to prepare, which we did with your dad, Sir Guy Lightspeed, which was a blast. And those have been our most played episodes because people go back and they clearly re-listen to them. Anybody who it becomes aware of the challenge, they start to Google resources for this and then they find those episodes. And they play them. I'm sure they've been played by multiple people multiple times.
Yeah.
And as a result, and you are a cycling coach, you're a multiple time Everester, double Everester, which we were just chatting about before we started recording. And it occurred to me that we really should do something very much like that, but more specific to the actual training demands of an Everesting. So Guy's episodes are more leaning towards the practical. Like, where do you park your car? What do you bring with you? What are the sort of surprises and pitfalls that you can find, which we've seen over and over again? Like, if you follow the Facebook page for Everesting, or the group, I should say, there's a lot of common mistakes that had they used those resources, they might have been able to avoid a little bit. But the training one seems a little bit more nebulous for people, I think. It's like, a lot of people are really good cyclists, but they come into this doing, you know, 4 or 5 hour rides or big rides, right? And then they try and take a really, it's a large leap in terms of the time commitment. So we thought it would be really cool to put together probably we'll release this in 2 episodes. We'll see how long it takes to get through the tips. But training specific. So you can take us away from there. But thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate you making the time. Right, and I think and this will hopefully, it'll be standing, it'll be there as a time capsule for years to come for people to go back and listen to, because a lot of the tips are going to be universal for people.
Yes, hopefully I can add some value and like make people's Everesting that little bit easier, because I know the training is, I get so many questions on how to train for it, and there's so many different sources of information out there that all say slightly different things. And I know just training in general is something that is not actually that complicated, but the public in general that rides bikes seems to just make it incredibly complicated.
I agree. Yeah. And I do believe that there's an overall fitness level we're trying to reach in order to do something like this. But I do believe there's some specificity that you can build in if Everesting is your thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I think the most important thing that's kind of, it's my first tip, and it's not really a training tip, it's a foundation of everything that you do, the foundation of all your training, and that's to really understand what the demands of an Everesting is, right? And simply, that's like, so probably a 14 15 plus hour ride for most people, and 9,000 meters, but I think 9,000 so they're the easy ways to quantify exactly what it is. And then if you're lucky enough to use a parameter, you can get even more specific with that, which allows you to, so the two main metrics I would use are the energy, so kilojoules, and training stress score, which is a combination of how intense the ride is and how long the ride is. And they're the two that I would use that would allow you to prep for an Everest thing. So I do long rides and quantify how long and hard those rides are without actually going and doing hill repeats, right? Because how do you relate a 200 mile flat ride to an Everest thing? Like, we know they're both hard, but how hard are they? Which one's harder? Right. And that's where a parameter, if you have one, is very useful. So when I did the double Everest thing and the 10K before that, that were hill repeats, I'd never done, well, I hadn't done for 6-7 years. I hadn't done hill repeats, but I knew by using a parameter how hard my previous rides were in relation to that double Everest thing by the use of kilojoules, really energy. How much energy does it take you to do those hill repeats versus doing 300 miles? And then how many train, what's the training stress score of that, which is just a fancy way of relating intensity and volume of a ride.
Okay.
So when you understand those, then you can start to plan your training around hitting those goals. So the X number of kilojoules that it will take you to do that elevation on a hill rep and the training stress score that that ride is. I hope that makes sense. I know it's quite technical, and if I start waffling off into the distance, just cut me in and ask questions.
No, I think that does make sense. And I think it's probably a relief to some people to hear that they don't need to do months of hill repeats in order to prepare to do a day of hill repeats. Yeah. Because that's it, you know, it's monotonous and somewhat mentally miserable. And yeah, to think that you need to spend an additional 90 days doing that miserable activity in order to prepare for it would probably deter some people. Or for lots of people, they might not live in a place where it's practical to do hill repeats or super hilly rides, but, and they're going to travel to somewhere to do their Everesting, right? Which is pretty common.
Yeah. So that's where energy is the one that I'm most of a fan of. So it's just kilojoules. So it's just power times time. So it's just average power times the number of hours times 3.6, which is just related to how much energy your body wastes trying to create power. Basically 3/4 of it goes off into the ether and doesn't actually go to the pedals. So when I ride, let's say my roams were between 13,000 and 17,000 kilojoules at about 800.
And kilojoule is about equal to a calorie?
Yes. So kilojoules and calories, same thing, all intents and purposes. And then you can work out that with that kilojoules, you can work out how many kilojoules does it take you to do a hill repeat. So for me, and that's weight dependent, obviously, because fat lad like me takes a lot more energy to get up a hill than someone that's 55 kilos. So for me, at 75-ish kilos, it's a one-to-one relationship between energy and meters gained. So my hill for the double Everesting was 240 meters. So it took me about 240 kilojoules to get up it. So that very simply, then if I'm doing a flat ride, let's say on training, that I'm running at 800 kilojoules an hour, I know that I can then relate that 800 kilojoules an hour to how many hill repeats that is at a certain power. And that lets you relate relate hill reps in terms of energy to flat rides. So my roams, for example, were between, I've said this, 13 and 16,500 kilojoules. So that is the equivalent of hill repeats of 13 to 16,500 meters of Everesting. Okay. So then I could work out, well, it's only another 10%. I can probably hack another 10% if I just rule five a little bit. So that's how you can relate the non-hill repeat rides to the hill repeats. So that's how I've always built my endurance rides, is I'm building it by kilojoules through the year. And that's another point. Sorry, I'm diverging. I'll get onto that. But that's how you can compare rides that aren't hill repeats to hill repeats. It's with the use of parameter. And time does a similar thing, but it's not quite the same. So time is obviously, anyone can use time. Time is just one of the basic benchmarks, but obviously time doesn't quantify intensity in the way that parameter quantifies intensity. And therefore it's 7 hours of hill repeats. Lots of people will tell you is way harder than 7 hours on the flat. Whereas the use of parameter quantifies that. And then you can calculate how much energy you're using, then you can start to relate them. I hope that makes a bit of sense.
It definitely does. Yeah. Yes. Okay. And I think the, I shouldn't say majority, but certainly a good percentage of people are at least training with power, at least on their stationary, right? So they can at least have a benchmark, right? And then try and relate that to what they're doing outdoors.
Yeah. So I've used power since 2015, since I started. And like, even now, I've only started relating that kilojoules to meters gained recently. So it's a labyrinth of topics and understanding, and I'm still learning as I go, having done it for 9 years. So it's a complicated topic, but when you start to understand it all, and then it's very, very powerful.
Okay. And then, so people, I mean, if they have a hill in mind, they could ultimately sort of work backwards to what type of kilojoule demand the total event would be, right?
Yeah. And so this actually, so for example, when I did the 10K on my hill and bottled the double Everesting, I could then go back to that file, I'd already recced it, but I went back to that file and went, okay, this is exactly how much it's going to take me. So I know exactly what number I'm after on my Garmin in an objective way, that time is quite objective, but distance and elevation are not objective, because that's another point, is that certain hills require more energy to do a given elevation gain. So the hardest hill to Everest on is the easier ones, like less than 6% require more energy, because you're wasting it on air resistance and rolling resistance in a way that when you get to about 8-9%, you stop wasting that, and then the benefits don't really continue past 20%. So I guess that's another point that I diverge a lot, because I just enjoy talking about it, but you wouldn't pick a shallow hill for those reasons, is that energy benchmark that you get with power meter shows you it's harder, which is why it takes longer. So that's
right.
That's why, because you're doing the same power, but you're not getting the same meters per hour.
It's just less efficient for the purpose of this challenge.
Yes, exactly. And what I realized when I was wrecking this isn't training, but it's interesting, is you get to about 10% and I stop being more efficient. And my guess is that's because I'm doing 9-10K an hour. But I was looking at one of my roams, I did hills that are like 16-17% average for a K, and the energy to meters gained was about the same as 10%. So I was like, well, there's not really any point going steeper than that, because I'm just over the front of the bike and it's much harder to eat and it's harder to descend. And so I realized that 10% was probably about right for the double Everesting and for Everesting in general, depending on how fast you are. The faster you're going, the more you'll waste on air resistance, etc. But for most people, that 10% is probably a sweet spot. Sorry, that's not training, is it? But it's just interesting.
No, but that's important, because this is a debate that has been raging on, I think, since the beginning of the challenge.
And that's where the power meter is very useful, in that it's objective. There is no subjective opinion. Like, it shows you that 10% is the most efficient, the best gradient to Everest on. Like, if you go at 5%, you're just doing more energy, and more energy is more power or more time, or probably both. And then it's just harder. Like, that's why my dad, when he's done lots of them, and he did a 5% hill and a 10% hill, and he said the 10% is the easiest one he's done, and the 5% one was 6 hours longer and way harder. It's like, well, that's why, because it took more energy. So don't Everest a shallow hill, because it's just making life hard for yourself.
Yeah, where were you 3 years ago? That was useful to know.
Yeah.
Okay, so understanding the demands of the event. Okay, that's tip number 10. We'll count down. What's tip number 9?
Tip number 9, make sure to include intensity in your year. So this is a big one, but like, for another, I'm going to use my dad, because he's a very good endurance athlete. And generally, he will ride less in the winter because the days are short, it's cold, it's wet. He's not going out and doing massive endurance rides, and therefore he might lose a bit of fitness because he doesn't want anyone to get home from work at 8 p.m. and get on the turbo and do efforts. So what happens is he just reduces his volume, doesn't do his big rides and goes easy, and therefore he loses fitness. So when you're not doing your endurance rides in the year, the big ones, obviously you don't want to do endurance and intensity at the same time, because that's too much. But you want to allow yourself to hit winter and do some intensity in that time, to because that's how you raise your threshold power, so FTP and your VO2 max. That is how you raise that threshold power, which affects all your power durations, and will make the Everesting easier. Because, for example, so I'm sure this is, again, it's quite technical, so it's power based, so feel free to ask me as many questions as you feel the need to. But when I raise my threshold, my zone two, i.e. my endurance pace, also increases. So if I raise my threshold 30 watts, my zone two is also up 30 watts. So then everything is easier. I just go faster for the same easy pace. And then everything will be easier. So that's how I'm doing it this year, is as soon as the days got short and the weather's gone dodgy, I basically just go, okay, I'm not going to do endurance rides anymore. I'm going to do intensity, and I'm going to try and raise my threshold so that when March, April comes around next year, then I've got some more power to work with. So my endurance is 20 watts higher, and then I can start doing endurance.
Okay.
That's why.
Now for some, yeah. So for the average person without a coach, yeah, that totally makes sense. Let's try and do some intense workouts, raise power. But more specifically, like, would you recommend some of the online programs that are built into some of the apps like Zwift? That would you do an FTP? I think there is one. It's specifically designed to increase FTP. Like, do you think that some of these ones that are pre-baked in work for the average person?
So the ones online generally have way too much intensity. I see them all the time. Okay. I'm just like, oh my word. So this is another point, but basically you can't go hard 1-3 times a week. And I only go hard twice a week. And all these things that the trainer owes with, just to call out a few, they all have 4 or 5 intensity sessions a week. It's like, well, if you gave that to Froome, like at his peak, if you made him do that for 6 months, he would burn out. Like, the intensity is universal. And this is another point, so I won't get onto it. But basically, if it's got less than 3 or less intensity sessions a week, then it's probably okay. But if you see it's got more than 3 days a week above zone two, red flag. Whoever set it doesn't know what they're doing, just long and short of it. And we'll get onto this more, so I won't jump ahead, but that's another one of my points, and I will explain that in more depth, because I know lots of people will have heard that going, what? Why is he so like fervent about that as well? There is some very hard sports science behind that, and it's the biggest mistake you see all the time. So basically, I wouldn't follow Zwift or Trainer Road equivalents unless, yeah, I would just be careful. I'd run it past someone, or yeah, if it's got less than 3 hard sessions a week, then maybe, but otherwise I would avoid like the plague.
Okay. 3 or less. I like this, 3 or less. You know, we can't make a podcast that fits everybody's physiology, their age, their,
yeah,
their,
so this is
their lifestyle
rule, right? That's, so it doesn't matter rule. Whether it's my mum that rides once a week, 3 times a month, like has sporadic, or whether it's Froome, or whether it's Pogacar, okay, me, doesn't matter who it is, like, you can't do that. And I'll get onto this point, so I will leave it there for now. But basically,
okay,
if you see it more than 3 times a week, throw it in the bin.
Okay.
I'll explain it more in a bit.
Okay, perfect. Okay, number 8.
So this is where we move on from intensity, and it's about structuring your, so like I've said previous, when you move to March, April, as the weather begins to come good and you start running outdoors more, and the turbo can be put in the garage somewhere, this is where you want to structure your endurance rides, i.e. your big rides, in build up to the main event that you have, whether that's Everesting, Double Everesting, Rome. So for example, if you take me this year, I did my first one back after my exams, and I had more time. It was 8 hours. Then it went to 11 hours. So I'm using hours because it's very easy. It's not technical, but I could go into the TSS and normalized power and things like that as well. But it went 8 hours, 11 hours, 14 hours. And then when I felt really good at the end of the 14 hours, and I was like, okay, now I'm ready to do the really big Rome that we did a previous podcast on. So rather than jumping straight in at the deep end, I built myself up gradually and structured that endurance with weeks off or 2 weeks off between each one, and then hit that big one when I was ready. And then I did exactly the same again for the Double Everesting. And I did the same last year. Yeah, so no, go on.
And when you say weeks off, you don't mean off, you mean off of intensity.
Yes, I just mean easy rides until I feel good again. So I will do one really big ride, and then I'll do 3 or 4 easy days. Like, but I never have, so this is another point, actually, this is the next point, so I definitely won't spoil that one, but I'll do 3 easy rides. So for me, easy is less than 2 hours, zone two. Whereas for my mum, easy is 45 minutes, zone one. For Pogacar, easy might be 3 hours, zone two. And so that's where, like, I'm not having them off the bike. I'm just, they're easy rides that I'm not adding extra stress to myself. It doesn't feel hard at any point. I'm just turning the legs over and keeping my body familiar with what I'm doing. So not off the bike.
Okay. I find that super helpful, not being off the bike. Sometimes I think it's psychological, but if I have a whole bunch of consecutive days on the bike, even if they're lower intensity, I feel really good and confident.
Yeah. Like your body, you just want to keep it ticking over. It's like, it will lose the fitness if it doesn't remember that it needs it. That's the way to think about it. It's like, if you don't do, if you're like, it's like me now, I'm applying for jobs and I'm going through these job application tests and it's like GCSE maths. And I'm like, are you like 15 year old maths? And I did well at that. And I'm looking at this now and I'm like, what is that? I'm gonna have to ask my girlfriend who's got a degree in maths. I can't remember how to do this. And your body and the fitness is exactly the same. Like, if you don't keep it familiar, it will throw it in the bin, which is why you lose fitness when you take time off. So I will say this because we're about to get to that point, but yes.
Okay. All right. Drop the next one on us then.
Yeah. So tip four is, I literally just called it consistency, consistency, consistency. So that is exactly that, is your body will lose the fitness that it doesn't need. So for example, I've had 2 days off the bike this year and I had five days off the bike last year. So I'm quite obsessive, but I know, so I assume, I completely understand most people can't do that, but you want to just, the more, just easy zone two, just tick over. So every ride is not hard. So I don't know, if I've done, 300 rides this year, I reckon 280 of them have been easy. Maybe 260. It's just easy zone two. So zone two is just like nose breathing, just ticking the legs over. The pace that you would ride an Everesting at, I will, like today, I'll go on the bike and jump on, do 2 hours of that. And that is way more beneficial than having the day off. It's like your body, if I go do 2 hours easy, my body won't lose any fitness. It will be like, okay, I'm good. I'm going to keep it. I'm not being stressed, but I know I need to keep the fitness. Whereas if I don't ride, it will go, oh, I don't need the fitness anymore. See ya.
So well, this podcast is very, it feels very permissive to me, because then I almost never take days off. I run or ride basically.
And it's what you see all the time is like the more junior riders, they'll do 3 weeks really good and then they'll take 4 or 5 days off. And I'm like, well, you just threw away the 3 weeks. If you've just done an hour easy 4 times, you feel great and you would be flying. The difference between riding a little bit, even 45 minutes, and having the day off is massive. It's like, yeah, I don't know. Think about what is the most skill-based sport. The cycling is the same from a fitness perspective. Like, if you don't play anyone that's played a skill-based sport, if you stop playing a skill-based sport for 3 or 4 days, you'll feel really rusty when you come back. Cycling is exactly the same, but just from a fitness perspective.
Yeah. It is not like saving money. It won't be waiting for you in the safe deposit box.
No, exactly. And there's a good rule that people use, which is every 1 day, 1 week off, it takes you at least 2 to get them back. And that obviously depends on how fit you are. But like, if you take 3 or 4 days off, it's going to take you a week and a half to get the same fitness back. If you take a week off, it'll take 2. If you take a month off, it will take you at least 2 months and more like 3 or 4. So basically consistency, consistency, consistency. And that only becomes because you do it easy. And so that's the next point. So I'll get on to the next point when it comes.
Okay. That's, and then for consistency, consistency, consistency.
Yeah.
Do you recommend anything different for somebody who's preparing at 25 years old versus 55 years old? Or is it basically the same as long as you're staying within your reasonable relative zones?
Yeah. So obviously, this is how well-trained you are, right? So my taking no days off might be the same as my mum. If I told her to be consistent, I'd be like, well, do 3 or 4 rides a week. Don't take more than 3 days off in a row. Don't take 3 days off in a row. Do one on, one off, or one on, two off, and just repeat that process. And then for like the average weekend rider that rides a bit in the week but isn't competitive, isn't trying to break silly records, is trying to do an Everesting, might be ride 3 times in the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, And one of those could, one or two of those could be short commutes, and then ride twice at the weekend, do 4 weeks of that, and then take a week off and think nothing happens because you've just thrown away the 3 weeks. So like, it doesn't have to be lots of riding. And obviously the consistency is relative to you, right? So me being consistent is different from Pogacar being consistent, maybe. But that is, yeah, so it's relative to you. So yeah, that's probably the way to phrase it.
Okay. And this will all tie into, I previewed the tips, so this will all tie in very nicely to one of the last ones. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We're halfway. What's the next one?
So this is probably the biggest training thing that I see people get wrong. And everyone from like national level athletes to like normal people, and that is understanding the importance of intensity discipline. And this is the most sports science-y tip out of all of them easily. And I think it's the most important thing you can know for endurance sports period, whether it's a run or swim or cycle. And so intensity discipline, basically your human physiology is broken, and the stress response that you have, so how tired you are afterwards, can be broken down by, there's basically one binary threshold of how tired and how broken you will feel afterwards. And that's the top of zone two, right? So a tempo, and that's a tempo workout, so zone three, zone four, zone five, will all have a very similar physiological stress on your body. And that's because this is quite technical, but the autonomic nervous system, so everything that happens in your body that you can't control, so like your heart rate, your blood pressure, your muscle soreness to a degree, but heart rate, blood pressure, hormone production, that all changes and is stressed when you cross that top of zone two. So that's what overtraining is. So overtraining, which I'm sure people will hear about, is when you just do too much of that. Basically, it screws your hormones, it screws your tiredness, your sleep pattern, makes you feel horrific all the time. And that's because you cross that top of zone two too much. And so that's what I was referring to when I said I'm consistent, because I cross that top of zone two twice a week. And that's definitely the bit you see people get wrong the most, is they'll cross that willy-nilly on endurance rides with their mates and they'll smash it up a climb. And I'm like, well, you may as well have done a really hard interval session, because you've just stressed that autonomic nervous system response, which is like all those involuntary things that happen in your body that make you feel good or not. You've stressed that, and therefore your body is as tired as it would have been if you'd done a really good interval session. And they're what I call junk miles. So it wasn't easy, it wasn't hard, so you're not really getting a training benefit from it, but you stress your body, so you're going to take 2 days before you're properly recovered again.
So now, for like the word discipline, that applies to both, right? So not only to have the discipline to do the intense work when it's on your schedule or within a day of when you're supposed to do it, because we need to fit this stuff into our lives, but also the discipline to not go above. But specifically, when you say zone two, does that mean averaging zone two in a ride or not exceeding zone two in a ride? Because that's a big difference, so, right?
Okay. Averaging zone two, I could do 4x10 at threshold, and if I have a long cool down or a long warm up, I've averaged zone two. So it's about that. This is where I tell people to use heart rate rather than power.
Okay.
So because obviously power lags and it's all over the place, and you can spike and you're not crossing zone two, your body's, because this is about your body's internal response, right? So that autonomic nervous system response depends on how your stress your body is, and that's where heart rate comes in. So I normally just tell people, don't put your heart rate above the top of zone two. So for example, me, max at like 205, threshold at like 187, the top of my zone two heart rate is about 160. So if I go out for an endurance ride, I would never let it go above 160. I might still surge out of traffic lights and round roundabouts, but I would never keep that surge going long enough to get above that 160. Because then when I've done that, I've ignited that autonomic nervous system response. My blood pressure has gone high, my heart rate's gone high, my heart rate variability will be screwed afterwards, which is WHOOP, which is another point we could talk about. All that stuff is stressed to the point where I've done what I would have done to my body if I'd done a hard interval session.
So this is the key. If somebody's going to take something away, this is the one.
This is the key. When you're doing endurance rides, don't cross that. Wear your heart rate monitor and don't cross that top of zone two, be really disciplined about it, because if you do, you'll just be tired and you're basically doing a hard interval session.
Don't race your friends to the top of every hill. Don't
race your friends to the cafe stop unless you're doing intervals on that session as well.
Okay.
Basically, that's the key.
Okay.
And I saw it with a rider that I worked with that had been being coached by a different coach, and I was looking through the training. I'm just like, what is going on? No wonder you're feeling overtrained and burnt out. Every endurance ride includes some sort of surge. Like, you should have been told, do not do that. That is the key to sustainable progress in cycling. It's like, don't cross that threshold. And it's the same in running. And it's why running is so hard for people that aren't pro level fit. It's like, running easy is impossible, really, unless you're really.
For some people, that doesn't even exist. There's no such thing as running easy.
You can't do it more than 3 times a week unless you're really good. And that's why running burns people out more, because you can't run easy. At least I can run easy. I'd have to train it. And cycling is exactly the same. And you just got to be really disciplined about those zone two rides and not go above them on every ride, basically.
Awesome tip. Okay.
Another big thank you to Tom for doing this with me. It was a lot of fun. If you enjoyed the episode, or if you like what we're doing here and like to help us grow our audience, the best way you can do that is by giving us a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding the show. And we will be back with episode 2, which will have the final 5 training tips for getting ready for an Everesting. And we'll have that out next week. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you soon.